So there are four monks sitting in some kind of zendo, and their prayer flags outside, and they start flapping against the building. So the youngest of the monks says, "Ah, flags flapping." And then one who's been around a little while says, "Ah, wind flapping." And then the third one says, who's been there like 20 years, and he says, "Mind flapping." And then the senior one turns and says, "Mouths flapping." So hopefully this isn't just mouth flapping, but so I'm going to explore kind of Gill's theme here of really this idea of the refuges and really these characteristics or these modes of existence that we can see to be true in our experience. So first, just pieces of this is there's this really this process of taking refuge or going for refuge, protection, safety, shelter. And first, just the first piece is Dharma and the Buddha and Sangha. So I'm going to explore a little bit of this idea of the Buddha. So first, I have to say, I've spent about a dozen years in Asia. And one of the truths of these practices is that it's funny, I don't have much faith. Okay, I don't know. I'm working on it. I've been in this almost 50 years, and I'm still working on it. But I also recognize that when I go to Asia, there's two things that touch me and kind of pull me along. And one is their openness, and the other is their faith in the Buddha. You know, and so just exploring that in some way, because in essence, the Buddha as a first, when you take refuge, there is the Buddha of 2,600 years ago, who, you know, he's been such an inspirer through these centuries. And even though I'm not, you know, Gil will know more, but in the sense of some of the historical reality, the difference between history and mythology. It has also identified and pointed to something that is so fundamental. And you know, in a sense, it's not that the Buddha invented Buddhism or anything, or invented enlightenment. He simply was able to really, as an example for humanness, that he was able to completely let go. You know, and in that, recognize or realize what is really how it works in some ways, you know. And our job essentially is, first of all, it may not be, you know, faith in the Buddha of 2,500 years ago, but there is a lot to say for it in the sense of we have to be careful. That's one of the things in Asia I find, that between our nature to want to deify something. And so you find a lot of that in Asia, where it is no longer just a human being who, through his life, achieved this state of awakening, but elevated. And we do like that. We're a culture, you know. We have all these Marvel comic superheroes, you know, and so we're not so different in some ways, you know, and it's an instinctual piece in us, wanting somehow to find something of, you know, that's farther or higher or better, you know. But it's also a great thing to recognize that somehow, you know, someone took on. In his life, he was Gotama Siddhartha of the Sakya clan, who, what we know, and I can't say that's what's mythology and what's true, but that he grew up in a very palatial for all said, things said and done, it was a time of great wealth and privilege. And I think sometimes one of the identifying pieces here, I see just in, you know, not just so much in the West, that we have reached, in a sense, kind of culturally or our cultural conditioning that is privileged, you know, beyond any time ever in history, you know. And so in a way, we're not so different than Prince Siddhartha in that way of privilege. And that somehow in that privilege, there are things that we know about, but we don't recognize so much, you know. Traditionally, the Buddha at the Siddhartha Gautama at some point, actually they call it the four messengers, where he had to go out of his cocoon and the palace and all his privilege and touch into some piece of reality. And that piece of reality was simply, first of all, that he was not exposed to old age, nor was he exposed to sickness, nor death, you know. And so these are the fundamentals that are known, but for many of us, it's not something that we hide. We hide death, we hide sickness, we hide old age. And yet they are part of the bedrock of life, you know. I know when I was about 16, I was in Egypt, and I remember we were going out, I don't know, to ride horses or camels or something near the pyramids, and there was a canal, and there was they found a body, a bloated body, you know. And as a 16-year-old, I was fascinated with the fact that here was something that was a human being that was bloated and fish had kind of eaten on it and stuff. And yet there was this fascination because, oh, is this something that somehow connects to me? You know? And it was actually quite, a bit of a, I don't know if you call it a revelation, but a reality of what goes on, you know? And I think we all have somewhere pieces of something that bring us into the truth of these inevitable truths that the Buddha came upon. And with that insight that he had into life, that I always love the fact that, you know, there's some people just say at that point, you know, he was married and he just had a child. And I always had this expression, because I know having children, that there's such instinctual love that comes up at birth for male, female. It just is kind of hormonally, whatever, natural that happens. And at that time, as we know, as a story or however, whether it's mythology or whatever, is that in a sense, became a deadbeat dad. You know, he kind of split for 7 years, you know. But if you can look at it as the kind of a deadbeat dad, or you can look at it like he saw life, and he saw life and he saw love. And he said, I have nothing to give. And at that point, he leaves the palace and his family to go in search the fourth messenger was a mendicant walking through the street that he said, oh, who is this person? Oh, it's somebody who is really searching for freedom. And at that point, it was his inspiration. Oh, I have to look for freedom, you know. And it began his path, which was in some ways for the times, was that was a difficult undertaking because it was based on the fact of that if you could transcend this world and leave it completely, then you would be free, you know. But, and the Buddha tried 6 years of austerities, you know, and basically, you know, that I love the, there's a statue in Patan, India, which has been replicated many times, and there's one actually at Spirit Rock, of where the Buddha, to touch his stomach would be to touch his spine, that he became so emaciated and such an extremist in this idea of seeking and transcending. And fortunately, he was to become a Buddha. Therefore, those austerities, there was more to it than that. It wasn't just transcending. There was something about being here and getting that somehow what he dubbed the middle way, that this awakening, this enlightenment that he experienced, was something very much about that was translatable, not about transcending, you know. It was really something that was available to the person in the here and now. And that was really his awakening. So that's one piece of it, is this person of 2,500 years ago and a bit, who was, we assume, a physical being who became awakened and was also some kind, I mean, I don't know for sure because I don't understand all the historical pieces, that he was just a great map maker, you know? He was able to refine this down. And whether it was over the years, generations, but all we know is that what came out of it, what actually came out of it, was really kind of an impeccable map that we know as the teachings of the Dharma, you know, and that we're sitting here and that we are children of the of that inspiration and that kind of codifying, that now we are finding means to kind of break down our own confusion and suffering and come to some sense of more wholeness in ourselves, you know. So there's that that you can look at and say, oh, this is really something that is, you know, greatly inspiring. You know, and many times when I've been in deep suffering of some kind, and I've been doing this a long, long time, and so there are different, you know, I've had all the different kinds of lives that most people have, and traumas and sickness and, you know, illness and stuff, and I still recognize that there is this possibility of this simple thing of oh, I go for refuge in the Buddha, you know. And so I really, and there is a piece of not so much of what it is, you know, it's but a kind of surrendering to this heritage or a truth that exists, you know. And it has been really a lifesaver. And if any of you get in too much trouble, I hope not, but, you know, the chances are you might, you know. And that actually to use this as a protection, as a shelter, as a, it is in a sense kind of, it's a kind of self-empowerment that can happen through it, you know. And then there's the process itself, sort of as second part of this is sort of Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey. And so if you don't want to take that as Buddha that way, you can also take it as an archetypal journey, you know. And so actually to look at his life and how he in a sense, archetypally, that his suffering, his seeking to be free of that suffering, and that that's something that, as an example, you can use as the story of his life, which is quite profound, in the sense that, you know, there's some part of all of us, I believe, that longs for freedom and awakening, to be free from suffering, you know. And that we also internally, we understand that we just aren't going to suddenly, you know, Gil's going to come along with a peacock feather and hit you on the head and it's all going to be fine, right? And I think, you know, I love Chogyam Trungpa used to say, you know, the ultimate and final disappointment, enlightenment. You know? The ultimate and final disappointment, you know? And so you start to see this is a journey, and it's not something that, you know, I think at the beginning we all have these higher aspirations, but then it comes to the fact that, oh, I understand. This is something that I take step by step, and I kind of, the Buddha said, I untangle my tangles and begin this process that, you know, in some ways, you know, as a Buddha maybe, but for us it's seems like a long process. But there's so much richness in the journey itself, you know. And so in that way, when you look at it as journey, it's not so much about the destination, you know, not the kind of pie in the sky. But these teachings are, they are, you know, visible here and now. You know, you can get this not about tomorrow, but actually right now. You know, and there is such, in that journey, there's such a comfort in recognizing that right now, this moment, actually you're sitting there and you're enough for all of this to go on, you know, and that you can actually learn to love this capacity to be present, you know, that no matter what the circumstances are, and what's true here is this is a pretty neutral place. Nothing's happening here. We came here because we wanted to kind of move away from things, and nothing's happening here. And so in a lot of ways, we're training ourselves here in how to approach this experience from moment to moment, you know, and in a sense kind of give it some ground or solidity. So that when we hit some wavy places, that, you know, we'll have some tools. And the tools are so the breath, the attention to the body, not getting caught up in the story, and recognizing that, you know, we have these reactions and feelings that due to the causes and conditions arise. And that, you know, we have these methods to, instead of pour fire and gasoline on the emotion or reaction, we can actually have a practice that actually will take and do the opposite, that will actually bring coolness to the fire, you know, the reaction. So that's pretty great. The third part of this, which to me is the kind of the greatest knowing of awakening, and it's really that the seeds of awakening are in you here and now, and that we can begin to take responsibility for the fact that, if I can say this, archetypically, you are a Buddha, you know, and that you actually have that capacity simply because that awareness itself, you know. There is the knowing of the awareness, and that awareness cannot be known anywhere else. It can only be known in the here and now. And that it in itself is fundamentally free. It is Buddha. You know, but it means that in essence, you can't go anywhere. You can't make up anything. You simply rest in the nature of the awareness itself. You know, and that it becomes, in a sense, your central, ground in some ways. I mean, we have this whole process that, you know, we're addicted to the reality of everything that has a charge is, you know, if it's unpleasant, then we're going to do everything we can to dissociate from it or move away from it or make sure that somehow we're not involved with it, you know. And that's our nature, you know. And the other side is as soon as any kind of pleasantness comes along, we immediately grab onto it. And, you know, then we try to capture it, imprison it, make sure that we get more of it, you know, at any price, actually, you know. And the ideas here is that this, we're constantly in this, all, it's this flux of in an impermanent reality. And we kind of move into the next part of it here. This impermanent reality that is actually distorting our abilities, you know, because when we're dissociating and fighting with unpleasantness, then it's about a struggle, you know. And when we're trying to grasp and hold on to some pleasant moment, it's also about a struggle. And what the essence of these teachings is that there is a kind of a point, a zero point, in between that pleasantness and unpleasantness. And that point, maybe we could just call it the zero point. But it actually, its essence is not about, in a sense, if I can use the word, happiness with the unpleasant, or actually happiness with getting rid of some unpleasantness. But it is really about a sense of peace, you know, and that sense of peace is actually always here with you. It's part of the nature of awareness. But we're so caught up in the charges and making stories up about everything possible, you know. And we're really good at the stories and trying to somehow embellish everything or, you know, or dissociate from it. And this is saying, no, I'm really willing to look at this center point, which is not involved in the struggle. So we're talking about a place of essentially the awareness that is not grasping towards either the pleasant or the unpleasant. It's just kind of sitting, knowing itself in the center. And we're, in essence here, we're training ourselves to sit in that center, you know, without a charge on anything, you know. And that becomes more the barometer of what we're actually willing to live with, you know. It's kind of always been a kind of a thing, these characteristics of impermanence, you know, and as kind of an essential truth that somehow all conditioned things, that means everything, you know, what you see is there is the objects of seeing, there is the knowing of it, and the I itself, you know. So we have kind of three things going on in just seeing alone, you know. And it never can be anything but change. And the thing is, you all have, you know, you know everything's impermanent. You all had your little science classes and all that stuff. And we sort of know this, but we know it intellectually, you know. And what we're doing here, probably the most profound part of this, is that we begin to recognize that training our attention, this awareness, whether it puts itself in the body or the knowing of a feeling or a thought. It's all just a river of experience, you know, that's constantly in flux, you know. And somehow the teaching of this, which is actually what one of the essential pieces here, is to almost get it on a cellular level, that rising and passing away is happening so rapidly, you know, that we begin to trust in change and see that happiness is actually, you know, we're afraid of change. It's one of the things we're always trying to kind of freeze things or hold them in some way. And but the truth is, you know, it's constantly in flux. So in essence, part of the teaching here is learning how to know it deeply enough. So when you become afraid, and when you become afraid, you usually dissociate of some kind or get really contracted. And, you know, you may make up a lot of thoughts about it or whatever that goes on. But suddenly at that moment, you recognize, oh, you know, this is a terrible feeling. And it is anicca. It is an impermanent experience. But I'm getting it from having sat here and actually recognize it. And I think for me, one of the big pieces here for the learning of that, the mind is so fast. It does just, boy, you can just jump from one object to another. But putting your attention, that awareness in the body, and you can never put actually the same, you can never put the same mind in the same body. It's always different. It's always in flux and change, which is actually a great gift to know this. You know, you can't fool this part, you know? And therefore, one begins to see on a deeper level that there is a river of change that's happening, that we actually begin to trust the river more than the objects, you know, and the experiences of the objects, you know? And that actually, we're talking about where that knowledge and that essential experience then is actually pointing directly to our ability to kind of recognize that zero point, that place of peace in the middle of chaos, you know. Because it's fine when everything is going along like a sweet song, you know. It's like, I get all this stuff, right? But as soon as there's contraction and, you know, some kind of threat, you know, this is where, that's why coming to do this kind of practice is so fundamental, you know, because it actually gives you then the tools to take your attention, go to your breath, you know, kind of calm down a little, and put your attention in your body and see that, oh, I know this. It's all right, you know. It's going to arise. It's chaos. And in essence, it's also, if I can stay with it, it's self-organizing, you know. It'll even if it doesn't turn out, you know. This is bigger than if it's going to turn out, you know, which is good to know, you know. There's also another piece of impermanence that's I think sometimes, again, it's harder to look at in some ways. And that somehow, you know, if you're not old, you're going to get old, you know. And if you haven't been sick, you're going to get sick, you know. Eventually, this all comes to kind of a crashing end, you know, one way or another. You know? And somehow awareness, when we start really cultivating these practices and seeing that, okay, I start getting that All of this is just phenomena, and it's changing. And it has, this has, in a sense, it kind of has a beginning, has an end, you know? And this awareness, there's the kind of molecular part of it, of seeing the rising and passing away of things, in kind of molecular. But the other is seeing it in pattern, you know, kind of in time. And that, and we can't stop that. That's just a reality for everyone. And getting to actually recognize this. One is about the peace and finding that zero point. And the other is about your heart, you know? Because when you start seeing that, oh, all of us, all human beings, everyone in this room, everyone's going to die here. There is no one's getting out of this. And so there's a way of, oh, when I recognize the kind of the nature, the impermanence of the river of the of my experience and of time, and that, oh, I'm not actually separate from that experience. Well, no one is separate from that experience. So it really brings you back to this thing, oh, you know, that I have created this illusion of a separateness. And that separateness, it has its functions in a relative world. But from an ultimate point of view, it's not actually true. And so part of these reflections on impermanent and kind of going deep into it is to break down the separateness, you know. And as we break down that separateness, then we begin to look at the world from different eyes, you know, because then it comes from insight and understanding of the consequences. It's just the consequences of living. You know, but there is then a sense of that sense of non-separateness, you know, touches you, and then you have the power to touch others, you know, because they too, no matter what facade they give you, they are still in the same process as you. I always think it would be fabulous, you know, if you know, it's interesting, if somebody kind of gets angry at you and you kind of recoil and your defenses go up, you know, and you actually kind of go into your shell and you know, make a bunch of stories or get angry or whatever back, you know, but wonder if you could suddenly see that, oh, you know, they had a really bad night, you know. Or, you know, they almost got hit driving here to work and it scared them. And so now they're kind of acting out in some way because of their experience. Wonder if you could actually go and go, oh, you know, I'm not believing the reaction. You know, I actually am feeling myself and I'm saying, oh, that's, you know, that's a reaction, but it's bigger than that, you know. And you can actually have then some empathy or compassion for their anger instead of your kind of instinctual, you know, closing down and, you know, you want to, you know, take a hot coal and throw it back at them, you know. So, you know, it's a truth, you know. Unfortunately, this is a lot of work, you know, because of the instinctual habit patterns. And so, you know, I always say, you know, Gil and myself, you know, we have life jobs, you know, this is, it goes on and it's okay, you know, because it takes repetition and it takes your willingness to kind of start over again. And I think always these practices is just start over again, you know, and that slowly you start untangling those, sometimes those defensive parts of ourselves that are there because of cause and conditions. I'm not saying, you know, We have all of our stories about our parents and our schools and all that that created our defenses. But we can actually begin to loosen them, you know. And to loosen them is the fundamental truth of your happiness, you know. Because as you loosen them, then that separateness, that sense of, you know, sometimes it's loneliness or not enoughness, or something that creates the psychology of separateness. You know, we come here, and I think some people look at this, and you know, from the outside, and go, you know, what are they all sitting there looking at their navels, and you know, and what are they doing there? But I really like to look at it kind of differently, that somehow you have to come here and, yeah, you have to turn your attention inward. And to turn your attention inward is to turn yourself inside out, you know. And inside out means that you have kind of broken through your defenses, and then there is a sense of curiosity and openness that is willing to meet the world. You know, and that's it. But yet from the outside, it's kind of paradoxical. It looks like, you know, this is all a kind of a thing of selfing here. You know, we're all selfing in our little stories, you know, but the result of it is actually the opposite. It kind of turns us inside out. So it's kind of cool, huh? So I think that's probably all I'm going to say about this weaving of, you know, one who is awake and the truth. It's simply the truth of how it is, you know, that all of this is just a river of flux and flow. And we can awaken simply and easily, and make a profound, profound change in who we think we are. You know, so let's just sit for a moment. Thank you for your attention. Don't get lost. And there's many levels to that.